Earlier this year, Late Night Live asked a question probably never before considered on radio. Why have so many statues that survived from the classical world lost their noses? Where have they gone? Why have they gone? At the University of Nottingham, we found the world expert on the lost noses of antiquity, who identified the cause. They were hacked off back in the day as an act of contempt. Which, of course, raised a question we've been keen to address ever since. If that's what they did to statues in Greco-Roman times, what did they do to people? It turns out a lot of hacking of limbs, hands, toes, for all sorts of reasons. And, which brings us to another subject probably rarely discussed on radio, the invention of prostheses. Late Night Live found the world authority on artificial body parts in the classical era at the University of Glasgow. Historian and archaeologist Dr. Jane Draycott. And she joins us now. Jane, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you for having me.
Jane, the oldest known prosthesis. How old? Where? What?
Well, it probably won't surprise people to hear that it's from Egypt, and it's from the sort of first half of the first millennium BCE. Now, this is the oldest functional prosthesis, of course. This is a toe. It's a right foot big toe. And there's actually a second example from just a little while later from Egypt as well. So we have these two toes that people who would have lost their big toe would have worn on their feet, either barefoot or with sandals. And we know that they were functional because they have wear on the bottom. So these were not post-mortem additions to complete a body. They were actually worn and used during life to make people's lives easier. We have some older ones that are not functional from much earlier back in history, but these were more sort of just, you know, representational. But these from Egypt are the oldest functional ones.
Jane, made of what, this toe?
Well, there are two of them. One of them is made of wood and one of them is made of cartonnage, which is sort of mummy wrappings, if you will. It's the same sort of material that was used to make mummy wrappings. So the wood example, that's quite interesting because Egypt wasn't overly endowed with wood because of the climate. So that was a sort of luxury resource, whereas the cartonnage was something that was a lot more accessible because it was used in mummification and everybody was mummified.
You said a moment ago that this toe was clearly used and was not just there for burial. Was there a tradition of sort of completing a body for burial if an arm or a leg had been lost?
Well, in Egypt, certainly, there was a tradition of making sure that the body was complete for the afterlife. Elsewhere in the ancient world, what you tend to see is a lot of the examples that we have today, in fact, I think probably all of the examples that we have today of prosthetics, they survived because they were discovered in people's tombs or in their graves. And generally, from what we can tell when we have a skeleton or the signs of a body, is that they were attached to the body in death just as they would have been in life. So, yes, I think it's fair to say that they were considered to be an integral part of that person's body rather than, you know, a grave good like a jar of perfume or a piece of jewelry or one of the other sorts of things that people tended to have in their grave next to them. A prosthetic was actually attached to the body.
And you didn't hide it?
Well, that's an interesting question too, because from my research, it seems to be that there was, certainly in the Roman world, where we have a lot more ancient literary evidence for the use of prosthetics, as well as the actual items themselves, there seems to have been something of a stigma attached to pretending that your prosthetic was part of your body. So we read a lot of criticism of people who had, for example, wigs or false teeth, and who were pretending that that was their natural hair or their natural teeth. Whereas if you made it very obvious that your prosthetic was not part of your natural body, that was actually the desirable behavior. So there wasn't this same pressure to pass in the ancient world as there was in the modern world. It was quite the opposite. If you pretended to pass, you were seen as being very deceitful, and you were trying to trick people into thinking that you were something that you weren't. Whereas if you made a big deal of it and you showed it off and you made it clear that this was something unusual and special, then that became in turn quite a prestigious expression of yourself, you know, your sophistication and your ability to access artisans and their talents.
Even hair, I mean, you make the point that wigs survive really well over time, but people sort of wandering Rome in a wig of red hair, did they sort of make it clear that it was a wig?
Well, I think you can probably, depending on exactly what you're doing with your hair, I mean, I think people are generally familiar with artificial colours, so you can recognise that certain colours
we're quite good at it, aren't we? Even today, yes. We're quite good at that. Yes, sussing out wigs.
So we do see blonde hair and red hair being particularly popular in ancient Rome for wigs, and these were taken from enslaved people, the Northern European Germans and Britons who were captured in warfare, and their hair was then taken and turned into wigs for the discerning Roman men and women to wear as sort of fashion and status symbols.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Dr. Jane Draycott, Senior Lecturer in Classics at the University of Glasgow, about ancient prosthetics. Jane, tell us the story of Marcus Sergius Silus. He seems to encompass so much of the classical experience.
He does, and yet the only reason that we know about him is one brief mention in Pliny the Elder's Natural History, which is an encyclopedia, which is, in my opinion, is one of the most fascinating texts from antiquity, because it literally has anything and everything in it. You open it to any random page and you'll find something fascinating. And so Pliny tells us about Marcus Sergius Silus, who was a veteran of the Punic Wars. And he lost his hand quite early on. This was a very protracted war that went on for many years. And so he lost his hand, his right hand. And Pliny tells us that this didn't stop him fighting. He insisted on being helped onto his horse, and he would swap. So for the Romans, generally, they would use their right hand for their sword and their left arm for their shield. And so Marcus actually swapped over. So he didn't have a sword hand anymore. So he wore his shield on his right arm, and he wore his sword, or held his sword, in his left hand. And so he went into battle like that and carried on fighting until the wars were over. But after the war, he was acknowledged as a war hero. He was praised for his heroism and all the damage that he took, but he kept on fighting. But after the war, his peers tried to marginalize him and prevent him from acting as a priest and undertaking ritual activity, because in their view, his body was incomplete and therefore he wasn't a suitable candidate. And so the reason that Pliny knows about this, and the reason that we know about this from Pliny, it's because he gave a speech in his defense in which he argued that he was actually an entirely appropriate person to perform sacrificial rituals and things like that because of the sacrifices that he'd shown to protect the Roman state. And so in Pliny's opinion, he says he was one of, if not the bravest men of ancient Rome. And so we see these interesting parallels with our contemporary world, this idea that you should be restricted from activities because of this idea that you're not suitable, you are incomplete, you are lacking, you are insufficient. And then we see someone that we would consider to be impaired or even disabled, advocating for themselves and saying, actually, no, thank you, I'm perfectly capable. And in fact, you're quite lucky to have me. And that's a really rare example of someone from antiquity with an actual amputation and prosthetic, because when he wasn't fighting, he used an iron hand. He had some sort of iron hand that he would strap on to his right arm. And so, yes, we hear someone in their own words giving their own account of their experiences.
That notion of the incomplete body being unsuitable for holy services, that lingers, doesn't it? That's still around.
It does. And certainly it wasn't even just ancient religion that sort of felt this sort of thing. You opened talking about the loss of noses. And what we see from accounts of the loss of body parts in antiquity is there is a very clear gender split. So when we read about men losing parts of their body, it's their extremities, it's their limbs, you know, through military activity, through punishment, through agriculture. But for women, it tends to be their faces that we hear about them losing body parts from. They lose their eyes, they lose their noses, they lose their teeth. And that's because people deliberately disfigure them in an attempt to punish them for some perceived slight or as some sort of revenge, as a way of destroying their beauty and making it difficult, if not impossible, for them to marry and to live a full life as a wife and a mother. And so clearly there is still a degree of stigma attached to people's, women's anyway, physical appearance. And we also have accounts from ancient literature of men and women being sort of harassed in the street, shouted at, you know, insulted because of their appearance, because of the loss of some sort of body part. And we get at the same time people saying, don't listen to them. Just remember with every step that you've taken that you lost your hand or you lost your leg or whatever else in the service of your city, of your country.
Yes.
And so we do see these competing impressions and these competing ideas. And this the same sort of behaviour that we see today, unfortunately. We even have examples of people stealing people's artificial limbs and corrective footwear at parties and things like that.
They've been shed for the party, and yes. But Jane, parts were not just lost through accident or battle, but there was also amputation. How was it possible in the classical world to amputate without killing the person?
Well, this depends very much on the time period that you're talking about. So our early examples of amputation are from classical Greece. They're from the Hippocratic corpus. And these talk about very minor amputations, fingers and toes. They're normally caused by frostbite or something like that. And so in that situation, because ancient Hippocratic doctors did not have the sort of medical knowledge required to do intensive sort of intrusive surgery, they basically left the finger or the toe to drop off on its own. Whereas when we get to the Hellenistic period, there's a lot of medical research in Alexandria in Egypt into the flow of the blood, and it's discovered how that you can actually ligate blood vessels and prevent the bleeding. And so it becomes possible to amputate feet and then gradually, you know, further up the leg. So more serious surgery can be done. And so what we tend to find then, we get these descriptions of how to do it. It still seems to be something that is only really done in extremis. It's not something that you would do on a whim or as a minor to deal with a minor problem. And we do see from the archaeological record, we have quite a few skeletons that have examples of failed amputations. So, you know, the amputation was done, and there is a little bit of healing at the end of the bone, but the person died very shortly afterwards. So we can infer from that actually it didn't work. They didn't recover. The surgery was too much of a strain for their body. At the same time, we do have examples of people who underwent amputation and lived afterwards for many, many years and used their prosthetics for many years. There's an example of a prosthetic hand from late antiquity, the early medieval period, where the person who lost their hand lost it as quite a young man, and he replaced it with a sort of dagger-type hand, and he used his teeth to pull the hand on and tighten the strap because there's wear on his front teeth that show that he did this over a period of many years. So I like to imagine this man as being something of a mercenary, you know, and wandering Italy with his knife hand.
And Jane, the prosthetics of the classical world were pretty much the prosthetics of the modern world until what, about the 17th century?
Yes, we start to see even a little bit later than that, really. We do see some investigations into sort of theoretical mechanical prosthesis and how you can make something that moves But for the most part, it's peg legs and that kind of thing until you get to the 19th century. And because of the Napoleonic Wars and the wars in the United States, suddenly you have a huge amount of veterans with amputations, and they need better prosthetics. And so that's when we really start to see the advancement and the idea of having something that you can move around, whether it's a leg to help you walk or a hand to help you pick things up. And then, of course, the First World War. We see lots of advances in all sorts of things after the First World War, you know, plastic surgery and facial prosthetics, as well as extremity prosthetics as well.
To be continued. Jane, thanks for joining us on the show.
Thank you for having me.
I've been talking to Dr. Jane Draycott, senior lecturer in classics at the University of Glasgow. She's a historian and an archaeologist, author of several books, including the book that you will want to read now, Prostheses in Antiquity. This is Late Night Live.